Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 266 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her boredom. What? Yeah, There's a science behind boredom. You're going to have a fabulous time learning things you never even knew. Before we begin the session, just know that our episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. Okie dokie, now here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review this top-rated show in all things women's health and lifestyle. I love to get your feedback, so this is your first reminder that after the episode, run on over to iTunes and give us that rate and review. All right, it's time for Her.
Her. The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life.
It's all about her.
So I'm reading the Wall Street Journal, and I'm saying to myself, something just caught my eye out of my skull. And I thought to myself, I'm bored out of my skull. I wonder if this is about boredom. And sure to form, there is this fabulous book review on a brand new book that just came out called Out of My Skull. And that's it. I read the review. I was absolutely enchanted with the science. Love it. And I said, we have absolutely got to get the author on the show. So wonderfully, Dr. John Eastwood is here with us today. He is a clinical psychologist and an associate professor of clinical psychology at York University in one of my most favorite cities in the world, Toronto, in Canada, obviously. And he trains future psychologists and conducts research on the intersection between cognition and emotion. You know, he also has a private practice where he provides psychotherapy to adults struggling with anxiety, depression, and relationship problems. And you know, it's interesting. He really loves to study how the feeling of boredom is associated with the unengaged mind. He's also just gotten a research grant from the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada to explore the cognitive mechanisms underlying boredom. John, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay, why boredom? Now, come on. You're an amazing clinical psychologist with all this incredible breadth of knowledge. I'm fascinated with why you chose boredom.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. You know, I think one of the reasons that I was fascinated to dig a little deeper and to think about it is because it often does fly under the radar. You know, people are standing in line at the grocery store. They feel bored. They feel restless. They get to the front of the line. They feel better. No problem. What's to think about? But when I started digging a little deeper, I realized that boredom is a fascinating subject that kind of has tentacles that lead into, you know, the humanities and philosophy and religion. And it was something that I noticed really hadn't been studied by psychologists. Sometimes things that are so common and right in front of us in our day-to-day life, we don't stop to think about them. And so I was really curious and wanted to dig in and see if we could approach boredom in a psychological way and try to research it from a scientific perspective.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And I'm just laughing. I got to share something with you. Years ago, when I began my work as an in-studio expert with the Today Show here in the USA, I was asked to do one of my first interviews with Katie Couric, who was at the anchor at that time. And the subject, I'm not kidding you, was boredom. And we were we started the entire conversation out by laughing our behinds off because they asked two of the least bored people on the planet to talk about boredom because we're all right. over the place. I mean, And then, you know, I looked up something then. I'm a stress physiologist. I'm a physician and a scientist, but I spent a lot of time at the National Institutes of Health studying stress, you know, cortisol. And I looked up boredom at that time, and boredom was seen as a form of stress. Now, explain that. I found that to be absolutely fascinating. Why is boredom a form of stress?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. We definitely, I mean, just to start, we definitely know that it is stressful, and we know that it's a form of stress by different ways that we might define stress, looking at cortisol, as you said, or looking at people's self-reports. But I think one of the really critical things to keep in mind is that our bodies are designed, you might say, for engagement. You know, we're built to use our mind to connect with the world, to express our passions. And when that process breaks down, when we're not able to engage our mind, when we're not able to connect with the world in meaningful ways, that leaves us in a vulnerable place and it leaves us unhappy and miserable. So I think you could also say that the feeling of boredom is uncomfortable, it's distressing, and that's good, or there's a good reason for boredom to be distressing, because boredom keeps us from stagnation. The uncomfortable feeling of boredom keeps us pushing and moving forward to find a better way. You could use an analogy here with pain, physical pain. So when you hurt your body, you feel uncomfortable, you feel pain. And that's a good thing because pain is a signal that tells you your body is in danger, your body's being damaged, take some steps to rectify the problem. And similarly, the discomfort of boredom alerts us to the fact that we're not in an optimal relationship with our environment. And that we need to do something to address that problem.
You know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, here we are globally struggling with this era of COVID. People have been home. People have been in lockdown. People are restricted in what they can do. And this is a global phenomenon. And so people are, one would assume, necessarily bored. Because of all the things that would distract them and engage them. I mean, you talk about an engaged mind, you know, there you have it. And one of the things in a lot of this unrest that's going on and back and forth that is being seen globally, it takes me back to a very interesting phrase. The idle brain is the devil's workshop. And, you know, with people who have nothing worthwhile to think about, they're unemployed, you know, could have been a graduate from either high school or from college who now doesn't have any place. There's no summer internship. There's no, you know, employment because you're restricted. And they're just bored out of their minds. And now they have time to engage in things that are probably not, you know, the world's greatest things to do. Mm. You know, something bad to do. I don't know. Mm. What do you think of that?
Mm. Yeah, well, there's lots of great ideas you mentioned there I can kind of jump off of. You know, the first thing I'd say is that we definitely know from research that constraint, so limitations, can lead people to experience more boredom. But the story is a little more nuanced than that. It's important to recognize that boredom is not just the result of an absence of possibilities. So the bored person is struggling with what I call a desire bind. And what that means is the bored person desperately wants to be doing something, but doesn't want to do anything that's on offer. So they can't muster up a desire to do things that are available to them. And so when our environment is constrained in some way, when we have fewer options, indeed, we might find less value in the options that are available, but constraint is not sufficient to cause boredom. It has to go to that next step of creating this desire bind, where you're caught between both wanting to do something, but not finding anything that's available, valuable enough to engage your mind in. One of the challenges and things that we could explore is, you know, how people can try to find value in the available options around for them. The other thought I had in response to what you were saying there is that, you know, during COVID, during these times of public health, when our freedoms might be limited or we have to comply by health regulations, there's other things going on as well. This is a very stressful time for people. It's a very difficult time. And indeed, for some people, they're struggling with tremendous problems and stresses. And we know that people who have gone through traumatic experiences are more likely to experience boredom. And this might be surprising on first blush. Why would that be the case? Well, the issue is, or the theory, I guess I should say, is that when you go through an emotionally challenging situation, sometimes that results in what you could call emotional numbing, where you kind of are distant from your emotions, or you tune them out, or you might actively avoid them or push them away. And emotions are like compass points that orient us in life and help us move towards things that are valued and help us stay away from danger or stay away from problems. And so when our emotions are numbed out, it's like being out in the ocean without a compass and we can't find our way. We can't be pointed towards valued activities that will engage and hold our attention. So it's not only the constraint of these COVID times, but also the emotional upheaval and the jumble of emotions that people are experiencing that can disorient them and make it hard to find activities that they value and that are meaningful to them. So that's another important angle that we should think about.
You know, when you were when you mentioned trauma, if I could just jump in for 5 seconds. Trauma is a real sweet spot for me. I really, really have gotten a lot of work done with trauma-based type of therapeutics, et cetera, because I think that not enough attention has been paid to people who do experience trauma. And it doesn't have to be a building falling on your head, a divorce. It could be, you know, a verbal abuse as a child, but no physical abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And I love the fact that you just related and correlated trauma with this issue of boredom and numbness. That I think is exquisitely important. I just wanted to emphasize that for our audience.
Yeah, it's something, you know, the relationship between trauma and boredom is not well researched and well understood, and there's only a handful of studies on it. We actually, during the time of COVID, we collected some data to look at that very issue. Now, we don't have the data analyzed yet, but it's all collected. And what we did is we surveyed people in the Canada and the US at time one, and we asked them about how they were coping with COVID, and we asked a number of questions and used some standardized questionnaires to assess emotional difficulties and emotional dysregulation and stress that they were experiencing. And then a week later at time two, we asked them about their emotion coping and emotion regulation strategies that they were engaging in. And then at time three, a week after that, we asked them about their boredom levels. And we're looking to see if we can find a pattern whereby people who at time one are experiencing a lot of emotional distress, then struggle at time two to manage and regulate those emotions, go on at time three to experience more boredom because of this emotional numbing that I spoke about earlier. So we're very eager to dig into that data. In fact, I'm going to be meeting with graduate students virtually to start talking about how we're going to organize that data set for analysis. So we're very excited to bring more awareness to this relationship between emotional trauma and boredom.
I'm so glad you're concentrating on this. I just think it's a ridiculously important issue that just doesn't get its fair share. So thank you for that, to say the least. Now, what's interesting, too, is if someone, you know, there were pictures of people, you know, when the COVID lockdowns around the world, you know, started in and back and forth, and you saw everybody just hanging out with their devices. Right. So the kids are home instead of going out into the street or the play yard or, you know, doing some kind of sport or something. Now they're basically stuck at home. What do you think they were doing? Hello, technology. So I'm going to read something out of that wonderful Wall Street Journal piece that was done. And I just thought it really hit it. All right. You speculate about how boredom and technology collude. So these are the words: boredom pushes us into the arms of technology, so much so that we cherish it and endlessly seek to develop new and better forms of distraction. On the other hand, technology leaves us ultimately unfulfilled, ensuring boredom's continuance. Talk to us about this whole thing with technology and boredom.
So that word collude is a really important word, and that word comes from Paul Thiel, who is a writer who was writing about Heidegger's ideas about boredom and technology. You know, so this idea has been out there for a while, and, you know, as I said in that Wall Street interview, you know, I'm speculating here as a scientist because we don't have the definitive research studies yet, but the idea would be that let me start by saying this. There's two ways we can orient our attention. We can orient our attention based on what are called exogenous cues. And exogenous is just a big fancy word for things that are loud, shiny, novel, unexpected in our environment that grab our attention automatically. We don't deliberately direct our attention there. Our attention is drawn there. That's exogenous orienting of attention. And then you can have what's called endogenous orienting of attention. This is where you're deliberately focusing on something based on your will, based on your desire, based on your intentions. So, you know, and we need a good balance between those two things. If you're walking down the street and you're engrossed in a novel, let's say, or you're listening to the radio, and you're so focused on this thing that you're paying attention to, you don't see the car coming, bearing down on you, then you could be in real danger. Right? So we need, you know, our attention to be interrupted by the external stuff when there's an emergency there. But what happens, or what I'm speculating at least, is that when we are so used to having our attention drawn and pulled this way and that way by external cues, which is essentially what our smartphones do, right? I mean, lots of smart people are paid lots and lots of money to figure out how to keep our eyeballs on our devices. And so they're going to be good at grabbing and holding our attention. But what's happening is that we're not willfully directing our attention based on our goals and our desires. It's being drawn this way or that way for us. And so another writer, Simmel, a sociologist, talked about using technology like falling into a fast-moving river where you get carried along and you don't even need to know how to swim anymore. You can forget how to swim. The river carries you along. And so it's like we're forgetting how to control our attention deliberately on our terms because we're giving over that control to technology. And so this is something that is concerning, but yet not yet confirmed through the definitive research studies, but certainly something that we're wanting to look into, you know, not just our lab, but other people wanting to look at this as well. And it starts to verge on some really important kind of moral and ethical issues about, you know, who we give the ability to control our attention, you know, who controls our attention, because what we focus our attention on essentially becomes our life, right? That is our life. And so it's very important that we develop in all of us, we develop the capacity to regulate and control our attention. And when that ability is not there, we're going to struggle to engage our mind when those external cues recede, right? When the smartphone goes away, when the credits roll on the movie, where now it's like, now what? You know, it's sort of like I remember talking to my daughter about that excruciating period between the end of one Netflix episode and the start of the next one, those 5 seconds where all your worries come rushing back or other concerns. But as soon as the new episode starts, your mind is swept away again with the new show. So this is something that I think we really need to think about is the relationship between boredom and technology and just how we're giving over control of our attention to technology and what might be some of the moral, ethical, and, you know, public health considerations of that fact.
I just love that. And I just hope everybody really heard your message there. And it gets even more interesting because now we're going to have a little conversation about what do you do with all this? Right? I mean, you know, how are you supposed to do it? So in the review, and as you say in the book, boredom is neither good nor bad. It's just what matters is how we respond to it. The main thing is to do something. And you recommend mindfulness, which is something, you know, my every other word, right, on my podcast. And the pursuit of flow. Now, obviously, you and I both know, you know what his name, I can never pronounce his name, but yeah. Thank you. Easy for you to say. With the whole issue of flow, which means getting so absorbed in a task that we lose track of time and forget ourselves. So boredom is neither good nor bad. The question is, it's a prompt to do something, and maybe it can move us into a different place that has more meaning and purpose. What do you think?
Yeah, those are great points. You know, there's a lot of moral judgment around boredom, which is sort of interesting, right? You know, I'm never bored, I'm too busy, or only boring people get bored, or our child struggles with boredom and we feel that we've failed as a parent, or there's something wrong with our children. So I think my first message is, you know, when boredom strikes, don't panic. Know that boredom is a normal feeling. And like all feelings, it serves a purpose. It's there to give us a message. We just need to hear the message properly and respond well to that message. And boredom tells us essentially that we're stagnating, you know, to put it simply. And the challenge, though, is to respond wisely. It feels bad. We want to get rid of the feeling. And so we often respond in ways that are, you know, remedies without cures. They get rid of the feeling, but they don't address the underlying problem. And so we might turn to our smartphone, as we just said, or something to that effect. And certainly when we're watching a movie or we're playing Candy Crush for the 100th time today, we're not going to be bored in that moment. So it gets rid of the feeling in the short term, but I wouldn't say that it's the best approach as a long-term fix. Why? Because what boredom is deeply telling us is we're not authoring our lives. We're not being agentic. So agentic just means, if you think about the difference between a cork in the ocean that's being pushed that way or this way by the forces of the sea and the wind and the rain versus a boat captain who's trying to chart a course and move to the other side of the ocean, let's say, or move into port. You know, both are facing the forces of nature, but one can form intentions and then act on those intentions. That's what it means to be an agent. It means to be self-determining, and it means to be authoring your life. And, you know, the superficial message of boredom is your mind is not engaged, fix the problem. The deeper message is you're not being agentic, you're not authoring your lives, fix the problem. So if we just turn to Candy Crush, we're kind of not really, we're not finding an activity that's flowing from our passion, our curiosity. We're not looking for an activity that gives expression to our abilities. And that's what we really want to do. So we want to use boredom as an opportunity to pause, to reflect. What matters to me? What do I find to be of value? What are my abilities? You know, what am I uniquely able to do? And who am I as a person? And can I give expression to that in the world? And those are the kind of passions that are ultimately going to keep us free of boredom. And in the long run, we're going to be the better for becoming more self-determined and more agentic in our lives.
I love it. I just beautifully articulated. And there was one little nuance that was noted, you know, in your interview. And that was the whole issue of maybe we all made a great mistake by giving up on hobbies. Now, that's kind of interesting. There was that issue of FDR, you know, our president's stamp collection, which allowed him to escape the burdens of the Depression and war. How many of us today could do likewise? And if we were to lose ourselves, you know, get into that flow, be mindful about a specific hobby, you know, it's a calming respite that's won through engagement. And it contrasts with our tendency to work on ourselves at the gym or divert ourselves by binging on Netflix. I love that whole issue of hobby. You know, it's almost like it has an incredibly important role in our life. But sometimes when you're just trying to find that meaning and purpose, hobby can also be a very productive place to just do something and just let things kind of, you know, marinate a little bit. What do you think?
Yeah. You know, you raise a number of points there. I think in our culture today, there's a lot of pressure on to be productive or to improve ourselves. And, you know, I get it, and that's not necessarily a problem, but I think it can sometimes become a bit obsessive or a bit too strong, where we evaluate ourselves and others through this lens of productivity rather than just being, you know? And so the one point I want to make here is that I see value in being idle, even if it's not necessarily productive. And I think the key is to be idle without becoming bored. So if you can sit and gaze out the window and daydream or reflect, okay, you know, what do I have coming up, you know, next month in my life that I'm going to be struggling with, or, you know, reflecting on things that you've been doing in the past. Those are all valuable human activities, even if we might not be able to say they're productive in the sense of I learned a new skill, I increased my reps in the gym and my workout. But it's about what another psychologist, Imerdino Yang, refers to as constructive internal reflection. And I think we need to recognize that constructive internal reflection has value. And when we can become engaged in that internal reflection, we're not bored. You might say by some definition we're idle, but we're not bored, and we're doing important work that's all about reflecting on, you know, like I've said before, who am I, what matters to me. It's making sense of the onslaught of information, right? We're in this information overload society. The ticker tape is rolling by, more and more information, but we don't really consolidate it or make meaning or say, well, what does this mean to me, if anything, and how can I make sense of it? And we need those quiet times. We need those moments where that external stimulation kind of recedes and we can turn inward and reflect and process everything that we've been through.
Oh, yes. It's called the golden moments of stillness.
Mm-hmm.
Stillness is just that beautiful concept. So, you know, for all of you out there in the Her Podcast land, I'm going to share something toward the end of his superb book here, which I just absolutely recommend, Out of My Skull, The Psychology of Boredom. In lieu of simple answers, we suggest the following principles. Seek out activities that clarify rather than obscure your desires and goals. Pursue goals that give expression to your values, things that matter to you. Do things for their own sake, rather than as a means to avoid something else. Pick activities that enchant your surroundings so you are drawn into ever deeper connections. Act so as to express and expand your efficacy, and find activities that engage you as a unique person and express who you are. And then the final coup de grace. Boredom confronts us with the simple yet profound question, what will you do? It demands an answer. There are few more significant questions. Bravo is all I can say, John. What an absolutely beautiful way to put it. And you're also a superb writer. So it was an absolute delight reading the book, to say the least. And everyone out there, seriously, I'm not playing around, because, honey, listen, I'd tell you otherwise, too. You know, be like, oh, my God, this was horrible. Everyone out there, we have been absolutely pleased and blessed to have Dr. John Eastwood, who is the author of the new book, Bored Out of My Skull. And this is The Science of Boredom. Just a fabulous book. Run on out, get it. It's a really, really mind-expanding way of looking at something that most of us just brush off, but it turns out to be a heck of a lot more interesting and really, quite frankly, more relevant to our lives today in the era of COVID-19. John, thank you so much for being on the Her Podcast. We were just thrilled.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm so happy that I had a chance to sort of share my passion and for boredom. It's an intriguing subject, and I hope your listeners can pause and just explore that, this really important and unique feeling.
Absolutely. Again, it's Dr. John Eastwood, and the name of the book is Out of My Skull. All right, everyone out there, run on over to iTunes right now and rate and review the show, because I know that this was that good. I want to hear from you. Feedback, it's the best. Why? Because I'm Dr. Pam Peek and I want to hear it. I am the host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. Stay safe and stay well.